It's the Super Bowl Sunday Sound Off here on SEScoops.com for Saturday, February 4th, 2012, being recorded a day early here. I am the Solomonster. Thank you, as always, for downloading the podcast. Want to give a quick shout-out to Ryan FL here at the top of the show. I was literally just checking iTunes on my iPhone to see who left the latest review. That comes from Ryan. He calls it a must-listen for any wrestling fan. That's what he calls the Sound Off. He says it is the highlight of his week. So, Ryan, this week's show is for you. If you want to leave a review on iTunes, you could do so right now. Leave some love for the Sound Off. I would very much appreciate that. It is, of course, Super Bowl 46 this weekend. The New York Giants against the New England Patriots should be a good game. I mentioned to somebody on Twitter who asked me for my prediction. I'm going to go bold here and say Giants over the Patriots 34-17. That's my prediction. Speaking of predictions, let's talk about the Royal Rumble. I gave my predictions on a recent episode of the Sound Off. I did go with Randy Orton to win the Rumble. I mentioned Chris Jericho would be my second pick, but don't count out Sheamus. Sheamus was my dark horse pick in this Royal Rumble, so I can't take credit for being right. I did say Randy Orton would win. I was wrong, but I was very, very happy to see Sheamus come through, and I didn't realize until the pay-per-view was over that the theme song they used for this show was called Dark Horses. That should have been a dead giveaway right there. So congratulations to Sheamus. Big win for him at the pay-per-view. I know a lot of people are very divided about whether or not this was a good thing or not. I think most people were upset just because they were swerved. WWE wanted to throw him a curveball. I'm not saying that's the best way to book, but that's what they did. But I don't have a problem with Sheamus winning. You know, it was nice to have a fresh face win. Just like last year, we had Alberto Del Rio, who was in line for the big push, even though he went on to lose at WrestleMania in the opening match. Hopefully Sheamus won't get that treatment this time. And it's interesting that if Sheamus does, in fact, go on to WrestleMania to meet Daniel Bryan for the World Heavyweight Championship, which I don't think is going to happen. I think either Bryan's going to drop the title before then, maybe at the Elimination Chamber, or if he holds on to it, this will probably morph into some sort of triple threat or multi-man match involving Orton and maybe Wade Barrett. I could easily see that happening. But if the match does happen that way, it was a year ago, WrestleMania 27, that Daniel Bryan and Sheamus got left off the card. It was a United States Championship match, if I remember correctly, and they had overbooked themselves, and so that match got sacrificed, and that was a dark match on the show last year. And that's the sort of thing you don't forget about. You know, that's something of a motivating factor, I'm sure, for the two of them. They'd love to go in there and tear the house down at WrestleMania, but I guess in due time we'll find out what happens. Let's talk about the card from top to bottom here. Just some random thoughts here from different parts of the show. I had a good time because I watched the show with friends and I split the cost with them, so I had a good time. Even so, this show was, I think in a word, the best word for it, underwhelming. It was an underwhelming show, and I reckon that had I watched the show alone, I would have felt ripped off by it. It was one of the more forgettable Rumble shows overall, I think, in history. I mean, as far as what did I think of the Rumble match itself, let's just run through the card first. We'll get to that in a second. Big Show trying to put his headband on Randy Orton's daughter at ringside. You know, her ducking to get away, I thought was actually one of the funnier moments of the show. I guess she must have seen what Big Show did to AJ, and she is rightfully terrified. As far as the opening match, you know, again, it's one of those things I hate about having two world championships. They get into this habit of putting one of the world championship matches, and let's be honest, it's almost always for the world heavyweight title, as the opening match. And no matter how you bill it, no matter how special you try to make it feel, if it is an opening match, it is not worthy of being a championship match for a world title. That world title means nothing if you're going to open the show with it. So, you know, even the people I was watching with, you know, in one case, you know, my best friend who used to be a big wrestling fan, he's more of a casual fan at best. You know, and his girlfriend who used to be a wrestling fan once upon a time and really isn't, are looking at this and going, wow, they're starting the show not only with a world championship match, but it's a steel cage match, and they're opening the show with it, and they thought that was kind of odd. So if you have non-fans who look at this and think, huh, that's kind of odd, then you must be doing something wrong. So they had the match. Mark Henry is still hurt. He's pretty beat up. And he couldn't do much, so it was mostly a battle between Big Show and Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan constantly trying to escape the cage. He got a little bloodied, I think, on his elbow. The match went maybe 10 minutes. Daniel Bryan climbing over the cage. Big Show basically palming him, trying to hold on to him, and just could not hold on to him any longer. He falls to the ground, and Daniel Bryan thankfully retains his world championship, which I was very happy to see. But at the end of the day, this match was really nothing special. Moving on here. I am tired of listening to Michael Cole continue to rag on Daniel Bryan, as he did here in the opening match on this show. Daniel Bryan is a heel. He's certainly mostly a heel at this point. World champion, no less. And Michael Cole on commentary still rags on him about he probably never had a girlfriend before AJ. When they did a storyline on their main show that Michael Cole also announces, by the way, that linked Daniel Bryan romantically with Gail Kim. I mean, do they expect that we just have complete and total memory loss and have absolutely no recollection? I mean, I guess we shouldn't, if you really think about it. I mean, it was more of a throwaway angle on that show. But still, for seemingly months, certainly weeks, if not months, we have this angle on Raw, the main show, between Daniel Bryan and AJ, the Bella Twins, were trying to get with Daniel Bryan. He was a ladies' man. They gave him the Dean Malenko ladies' man character. Are we supposed to pretend like that never happened? He never had a girlfriend before AJ, you fucking idiot. Of course he did. Anyway, John Cena and Kane. The first thought I had when Cena came out, so much for Cena's angry face on Raw last week. Everybody made such a big deal about the John Cena, you know, the Incredible Hulk deal where he just stared into the camera and he got very angry and his face got all scrunched up. And you thought, wow, this guy's going to come to the pay-per-view and just tear Kane a new one. It's going to be a John Cena like we've never seen before. And in fact, I mean, you could say that on Raw the next night we actually got that John Cena, but at the Royal Rumble, he came out like jolly old John Cena, just like he always does, smiling and pandering to the crowd, and then proceeded to have a normal wrestling match with Kane for some time. I don't understand that, considering how they left it on Raw the previous week. You would think Cena would come out, he would, take no shit, go right after Kane, and that just was not the case. As far as the match itself, whatever. I mean, it wasn't anything overly special. I will say this, though. I have to give credit where credit is due. As cheesy as it was, you know, Zack Ryder wearing the full body brace, the back brace, whatever the hell it was, and this whole storyline sucks. But when I looked at the scene of chaos at the end of this match with bodies everywhere and the referees down at ringside, I thought to myself, that's how you're supposed to book Kane. Again, I hate this storyline, but the visual of Zack Ryder and John Cena laid out with Eve crying, tears streaming down her face, mass carnage, made this man look like a monster for the first time since he came back. And so again, as much as I hate on this storyline, that's the way Kane should be booked. Beating people up left and right, leaving nothing but destruction in his path. I like that. Everything else about this I hated, but that I liked. I said before that last year at the Royal Rumble was a pivotal night. It was a pivotal moment in the career of Dolph Ziggler because he was being given the ball. He was being given a championship match on pay-per-view against Edge, who at the time was the World Heavyweight Champion. And that was one of the highlights to me of 2010, or 2011, I should say. And to me, Dolph came through in that match. And now he's one of the... He really is... Look, the way he's being booked is shitty for him. He's been losing left and right. He seems like a man with not much in the way of direction right now, but just the fact that he's being used as often as he is, and the fact that the company looks at him as somebody who is a great worker, who they can put in the ring with other people who maybe aren't as good, and he can make them look good. That's a position for him to be in that's actually not too bad, because the company sees value in him. So he's come a long way. It's not one of these situations where I'm going to worry that the next round of cuts WWE makes, Dolph Ziggler may be cut, because to me, obviously, that would be a big mistake. So Dolph Ziggler goes into this match a year later here at the Royal Rumble, another championship opportunity for him, this time against CM Punk for the WWE title. But the match was not about him at all. Obviously, the match was all about John Laurinaitis, who was supposed to be the referee, and of course was not. So it was Mike Tyson at WrestleMania 14 all over again, where Laurinaitis was actually the outside enforcer, even though he came into the ring at the end of the match to help count the fall. He was, in fact, not the referee for this match, so in a way it's false advertising. But it was about Punk and Laurinaitis, who pretty much gave you the blow-off on Raw 6 days before when Punk gave him the GTS. I mean, he took all of the tension that was mounting. Is Punk going to actually kick this guy's ass, as he promised he would do if he tried to screw him? What's going to happen at the Royal Rumble? I'll pay to see it. And they pretty much gave you what you wanted to see on TV 6 days before the pay-per-view. Not only that, but at the Rumble, what ended up happening is there was no screw job. Punk did not lay one finger on Laurinaitis. I mean, he may have, I think he pushed Ziggler into him, or he may have kicked him in the head by accident. Whatever happened, he took a very minor bump, Laurinaitis did. But for the most part, it was even Steven. There was no screwing going on, which was fine. You know, it was nice to have a pretty clean outcome, but that's not what this match was all about. They didn't build this match as a big feud between Punk and Ziggler, or an athletic competition between Punk and Ziggler. And the worst part about it is these guys have had better matches. You know, this was their big pay-per-view title match, and the match was good. You know, at best it was good. I had higher expectations for this match. It was overshadowed by the bullshit, and the match itself was not what I was hoping it would be. So this was actually a disappointment more than anything else. Like I said, I've seen better from both guys. They deserve better. And the thing I also didn't like about this was Dolph Ziggler essentially lost four times in the same match. And then he loses to Randy Orton the very next night. So this goes back to what I was saying before. You know, Ziggler's in a good position in that I think his job is safe. And people in the company know how good he really is becoming. But at the same time, since he lost the U.S. title to Zack Ryder, what has Ziggler done? I mean, he may have gotten a couple of fluke wins over CM Punk. Big deal. He lost four times in this match to Punk. And then he went out on Raw the next night, had another great match with Randy Orton, I'll talk about that later, and lost again. But hey, he's getting another championship opportunity at the next pay-per-view, I guess, so good for him. Royal Rumble time. The big 30-man over-the-top Royal Rumble match, one of my favorite events of the year. We've had some shitty Rumbles, we've had some great Rumbles. I had, I don't want to say high expectations, but you know, I expected this to be a good Rumble, and it was not a good Rumble. And in fact, I'll state right here on the record that I thought this was easily one of the worst Royal Rumble matches of all time, going back to 1988, going back to 1987, to the original Royal Rumble that never was, that they don't even acknowledge because it wasn't on TV. And I think I don't remember where it was held, but there was a Rumble in 87 that they don't make reference to, and I never saw it. And without even seeing that Rumble, I'm sure that Rumble was better than this one. This was, you know, in 25 years of Royal Rumbles, to me, if I ranked it, it would have to rank in the bottom five. Maybe even the bottom three, but I'll say bottom five, because there have been some bad Rumbles before. You know, and I know at least one person, David, on our Facebook page, was actually in attendance in St. Louis at the show, and he said he had a blast, which makes sense. I mean, I was at Madison Square Garden for the 2008 Royal Rumble, and I had a great time, but I'm not sure that I would have had I watched that at home on TV, especially with that god-awful abrupt ending to the Randy Orton-Jeff Hardy title match, if you remember that. But being there live is always more fun, getting to count down the entrance and all that. But on pay-per-view, it's a different story. And this Rumble match was no good. There was way too much comedy. We never really had more than a few guys in the ring at once, which I actually like. I hated it when Diesel kept tossing guys out left and right back in 1994. They still call that the Diesel spot. But you can make the argument, you know, we're building a guy. Okay, fine, we want to give somebody the Diesel push. So we'll have him go in there and dump five, six guys out, make them look strong. And they did, you know, they still refer to that as the Diesel spot, as I said. But this year, you didn't have that one guy who gets made by tossing a bunch of nobodies. I thought Brodus Clay might get that spot, even though he's got the comedy gimmick, but they kept him out of the match altogether in favor of putting him in an enhancement match, a job match, on pay-per-view with Drew McIntyre. The same Drew McIntyre who apparently has been fired about 15 times on SmackDown, but somehow he keeps popping up. He's like a cockroach. He won't go away. You know? So they couldn't put Brodus in the Rumble, as though Brodus getting eliminated here would have killed his heat. I mean, give me a fucking break. So you put Brodus in the Rumble, he tosses a couple of guys, he does a dance spot in the middle of the match, everybody claps and has fun, and then somebody dumps him from behind, and people probably boo, because they did not want to see Brodus get thrown out, so it gives heat, it puts heat on whoever dumped him. Could have been Miz, could have been Dolph, could have been Cody, but nope, they didn't do it. Keep him out of the Rumble match. Too much fun. Anyway, you didn't have that one dominant monster this year. You just had a bunch of random guys who kept throwing people out. So at any given moment, we had maybe three or four people in the ring at one time. And to me, that always makes the Royal Rumble less fun. You know? I'm not saying it needs to be like a battle royal where you've got 20 guys in at once and people can barely move, but, you know, that was one of the things. Everybody kept being dumped, and there's two, three people in the ring. I'm like, what's going on here? We're already halfway through the Rumble. This is no fun. The other thing that I noticed here was the lack of star power was as noticeable here as maybe any other point in Rumble history, with the possible exception of 1995, which was pretty bad. This was the jobbers on parade until about midway through the match. I mean, this was 1999 level here. That was the Rumble that had guys like The Godfather and Draws and the artist formerly known as Goldust and a bunch of freaks. You know, the 99 Rumble was pretty bad, too, and that was at WWE's peak when business was booming. But this was around that level here in terms of just the nobodies that came down to the ring for this match. And I realize they have a lot of guys injured right now. I understand that. But it's absolutely inexcusable. Whoever laid this match out really had to do a better job of mixing up the order with the top stars. Because you had some top stars in there. You had Jericho. You had Randy Orton. You could put Sheamus in that category. I'm actually drawing a blank on who else. Miz. You know, Miz barely is a top guy. And he came out. Okay, Miz came out at number one. And Miz, as I predicted, did do the Iron Man thing this year. You know, Miz went 45 minutes. As I said, he was going to go 30 or 40. He went 45 minutes. Actually, Cody Rhodes wasn't too far behind him. He went about 42 minutes. But other than maybe Miz, and that's a stretch, they saved all of the big names for the very end of the Rumble. So for the first half an hour to 40 minutes, the first 15-plus people who came down to that ring, for the most part, with a couple of exceptions, it got to the point where even the people I'm watching with, who are not big wrestling fans, but they're looking for big names, are looking over at me saying, wow, this Rumble sucks. And I didn't have a real defense for it because I also was kind of bored, quite frankly. I was looking at my watch. I'm saying, God damn, I mean, I look forward to the Rumble every year. It's already half over. This sucks. When David Otunga comes out at number 27... and then the big climax at number 30, and everybody has been conditioned to think, oh, number 30 is going to be a big name or a surprise name, and it's Big Show. Big Show at number 30. That's a bit of a letdown right there. I mean, I actually would have much preferred Kane in that spot. You know, for the people saying, well, if not Big Show, Solid Monster, Hot Shot, who would you put in there? I'd put Kane in that spot. Keep his consecutive streak of Rumble appearances alive, which I think is now over at 13. And just let him kill some dudes before having John Cena run down and eliminate Kane, since that feud apparently is going to continue anyway against my wishes. You send Kane down there. Kane was certainly in tip-top shape when his match ended, so he could have gone down there, thrown a couple of guys out, been made to look even stronger than he was earlier in the night, build him up as a real monster. You have Cena come down in a fit of rage since he, you know, his best friend was killed again earlier in the show. So it would make total sense for Cena to come down and distract Kane and cause him to be eliminated. That at least would have made more sense. So the whole time, the theme of this Royal Rumble was, that's it? If I had to pick one theme for the Rumble, that's it? That's all I kept thinking as this match went on. Very, very disappointing. I absolutely hated Alex Riley coming out and then R-Truth at number 2 and 3. I mean, I actually called Riley coming out like 10 seconds before it happened. Because I figured, look, it would be way too transparent to have Truth come out at number 2, so have Riley come out at number 2. So what do? They have Riley come out at number 2 to feud with Miz. Obviously, there's a history there. And then at number 3, they couldn't help themselves. Let's put R-Truth out there. Random my ass, this Royal Rumble is. At least try to convince us that it is somewhat random. I mean, what complete horseshit that was. Oh, my goodness. Another thing here that pissed me off. By the way, I did like some things about this Rumble. I don't want to rag on it too much. I'm just going to save that for the end. But I got a couple things more to rant about here. One startling realization that hit me in this match is that Mick Foley, God bless Mick Foley, but he has got to hang it up for good. Watching him run to the ring, and I use that term very loosely, run, was beyond sad. I mean, he was barely mobile once he was inside the ring. He did the comedy spot with Santino, the Sacco against Cobra spot, which was cute for what it was. But, you know, it's the sort of thing that makes you cringe when you're watching the show with, you know, either non-wrestling fans or people who don't follow it as much anymore. But watching Foley move around here just made me cringe, you know, and it made me change my mind on a potential Mania match with Miz or Dolph Ziggler. You know, I had figured book Miz in a match with Foley of Mania to toughen Miz up. He can have a I mean, you know, Foley in today's PG WWE can't have the sort of match he used to have. Even the match he had with Edge at WrestleMania 22 with the fire and the blood, that would never be allowed. So I don't even know how much of a hardcore match Foley can even pull off in the current WWE environment. I don't know how much Miz would really benefit from it, but I figured, you know, Miz is a guy who has no direction right now. He's losing and losing and losing, and they're trying to make him look tough, and they've pretty much given up on that because he's been booked to look like nothing more than a pussy. If you want to toughen him up a little bit, put him in a match with Foley, give him some rub at WrestleMania, and put him over Foley. And then we saw the promo a couple weeks back with Dolph Ziggler and Foley, and it looked like maybe they were teasing a Dolph Ziggler-Mick Foley match, and I thought, okay, this might not be so bad. Well, I've changed my mind. That would be a very bad idea. I do not want to see Mick Foley in a singles match at WrestleMania. As much as I respect him, I like him, I'm sure he's a really nice guy, he should not be wrestling anymore. He should certainly not be wrestling a singles match. And I think he realizes that because I've heard him make comments in interviews over the last week or so to that effect. You know, maybe he'd be better in a tag match or something. Even a tag match, it's over. I mean, his time is over. He can barely move. And the same could be said for the Great Khali, who, you know, he walks, the way he walks, very awkward. And he walks that way because his knees are completely shot. I mean, Khali also is a guy, quite frankly, in his condition with his, you know, physical ailments, who should not be wrestling. Can barely move. It's embarrassing. Anyway. My friend's fiance, by the way, who, as I said earlier, isn't really a wrestling fan, was watching this, and when Jack Swagger came out, she made the comment that Jack Swagger looked like a dyke. That was her word, not mine. A dyke. Wow. I guess it was the hairdo. I don't know. Let's just hope he doesn't start coming to the ring wearing a leather jacket. Wade Barrett came to the ring for the Rumble, and I realized, motherfucker, he got another theme change. They changed his music again, and it sucks badly. Him and Cody Rhodes actually had pretty good music, and they went and they changed it. The Dolph Ziggler's theme, they changed. What is wrong with these people in this company with the theme music changes? Pick one fucking song and stick with it. Build Me Up Buttercup at this point would be a better theme song for Wade Barrett than that piece of shit song he came out to at the Rumble. Then we had the finish of the Rumble, and the people who are shocked or underwhelmed by Sheamus winning the Rumble match simply have not been paying attention. This is classic WWE booking 101. Okay, I figured this out here. You beat someone down, or you put them in on a losing streak, and then you reward them by putting a title on them, or giving them a big win, like the Rumble match. They just did this very same thing with Daniel Bryan. He won Money in the Bank, and then got jobbed out for months before they gave him the World Heavyweight Championship. I mean, really, when Sheamus lost that Battle Royal to Hornswoggle on SmackDown all those weeks ago, I don't know why I didn't realize it then. It should have set off alarm bells at that point, as far as what they were going to do. Add that to the fact that he's been feuding with Jinder Mahal, of all people, for the last 3 months, and it all makes perfect sense. It is perfectly logical WWE booking that Sheamus would go over in this match after all that. It's really not much of a surprise at all. And the other thing here is that Sheamus almost has to win the championship at WrestleMania. I don't care if he faces Daniel Bryan, if he faces Randy Orton, if it's a triple threat match. Sheamus has to get the title shot, and he has to win. Because I'm watching that Royal Rumble numbers video they put together, which was very well done, and they showed it a whole bunch of times. And that 55% statistic in that Rumble video, 55% of Royal Rumble winners have gone on to win the championship at WrestleMania. That doesn't exactly speak very well to the Rumble match actually meaning much to the person who wins it, now does it? 55%? That's not a very good batting average at all. They've got to up that number a little bit. Sheamus has to go to the WrestleMania, and he has to win the championship, or else, math is not my forte. I don't know what that number would drop to. It may fall under 50%. And in that case, who the fuck cares who wins the Royal Rumble? So, yeah, they got to work on that. But like I said earlier, there were things about the Rumble I liked. Things about the Rumble match, which went about 55 minutes this year. As I said earlier, Miz was the Iron Man. He was in there for 45 minutes. Cody Rhodes was only a couple of minutes shy of that. So they had pretty good performances in the Rumble. Ricardo Rodriguez coming out in that Nissan Datsun was fantastic. I thought to myself, wow, Del Rio was actually healed up earlier than expected. And then I saw Ricardo sitting in this beaten-up old Datsun, And he's got the towel, just like, you know, just like Del Rio, doing all the mannerisms. People were cheering him. People loved this man. And he was actually in there a few minutes longer than I thought he would be. So Ricardo was great. It was great to see him doing that. Kofi Kingston, I guess he gets the John Morrison Award for Spot of the Night. Doing that handstand on the outside was very impressive. But again, as you can make the argument with what Morrison did last year, why wouldn't this guy just stand on one leg and hop back into the ring instead of risking it, instead of risking elimination by doing a handstand? You know, instead of Morrison last year risking elimination by, you know, having to walk across the barricade and do a vertical leap onto the steel steps. It was very impressive, but if you think about this logically, I'm just saying, I would hop on one leg. That's what Jerry Lawler did once in a battle royal. Until Bret Hart came down to the ring, and I think he either stepped on his other foot or he punched him in the head and he eliminated him, the bastard. Karma came back in the Royal Rumble. That was pretty cool. Got a big pop. She came down to the ring and I guess to try to eliminate Michael Cole, who had no business being in the Rumble, but he was, so I guess he gets a Rumble payday. I think Cole eliminated... No, Cole did not. Cole climbed over the top rope to escape Karma, and then Booker T and Jerry Lawler yanked him off the apron to eliminate him. But Karma came back, and she gave the implant buster to Dolph Ziggler. Very impressive. She also dumped Hunico. People were going crazy. They loved Karma. And then Dolph Ziggler dumped her out, and I was a little worried because when she got dumped out, if you go back and watch it, it looked like she might have twisted or rolled her ankle. I thought maybe she injured her ankle. Apparently she's okay, so that's good. Road Dogg was another surprise in this Rumble. He got a very big pop, certainly better than the one he got when he made an appearance at the Slammy Awards back in December. So that was cool, doing all of his old spots. He got the You Still Got It chant, the same chant that Rock got at Survivor Series. So good for him. And who else came back? Oh, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, as I predicted. Duggan did, in fact, appear in the Rumble. He was the winner of the very first televised Rumble in 88. And so 25 years later, here he is in this one. Makes sense. Also got one of the biggest reactions of the entire Rumble, which I'm not quite sure what that means. I know Duggan is a beloved figure, even though he was never a world champion in WWE or anything like that. But the fact that Hacksaw Jim Duggan at age 50, whatever he is, can come down to the ring and get a bigger pop than almost anybody else in this Rumble match, I think speaks less of the current stars than it does of Duggan. So that's a little awkward there. But the finish with Jericho and Sheamus I thought was very well done. I did not expect Randy Orton to be dumped out. He was in the Rumble really not all that long. And again, the Rumble was in his hometown of St. Louis. This was Orton's first, I think, in-ring appearance of any kind since the injury in many, many weeks. And so he got dumped pretty quickly, and I think people were genuinely shocked by it. So it came down to Jericho and Sheamus. I think they went at it for about 6 or 7 minutes, very reminiscent of the Undertaker Shawn Michaels finish to the 2007 Rumble, where it came down to the two of them, and they wrestled like another 10 minutes, or almost 10 minutes, until Undertaker won. This was not quite as good as Undertaker and Michaels, big surprise. I mean, very few people could possibly match what Undertaker and Michaels can do in the ring. But I thought this was very good. And I really couldn't call it. I think it could have gone either way. I at that point, I just assumed Sheamus was winning. But if Jericho would have won, I wouldn't have been surprised. And Jericho's on the apron, gets a brogue kick to the face, gets knocked off, and that's it. Sheamus wins the Royal Rumble. So as I said earlier, congratulations. It's always nice to see a fresh face win the Rumble. Jericho did not have to win, even though it would have made more sense for him to win, being that he just came back. He really hasn't wrestled a match. Unless you count the match he walked out on a couple of weeks ago. So essentially in his first match back, he got beat. I'm not quite sure I agree with that, but I guess we'll see how things play. In the long run, it's not going to mean a goddamn thing, so I can't get too upset about it. So yeah, Sheamus wins, no problem there. But as far as Rumble matches go, I will reiterate, one of the worst Rumble matches of all time. I mean, there's just no other way to put it. And there have been some bad Rumbles. As I said, 1995 was a bad Royal Rumble, until the finish anyway. In recent years, a lot of the Rumbles have been forgettable. 2010, I think, is when Edge won. I don't remember that being a particularly good Rumble. Last year was the 40-man Rumble, which also wasn't all that great, but it had its moments. But I was a fan of 2005. I was a fan of 2007, 2008 being there. There have been some good Rumbles. This was not one of them, even with some of the good moments in there. This was a very, very disappointing, underwhelming, lackluster Royal Rumble match, easily one of the worst of all time. Now, coming off the Rumble, my fear was that, wow, that show really disappointed. That's not a good way to get started on this supposed road to WrestleMania. I'm happy to report Monday Night Raw the very next night, a completely polar opposite to the Royal Rumble. This was a great show this week. One of the best editions of Raw I can remember in recent memory. In particular, the first hour of this show may have been the most enjoyable first hour of Raw in ages. It was capped off by a great match between CM Punk and Daniel Bryan, their first WWE encounter. WWE tends to kick it up a notch around this time of year for WrestleMania. This show, more so than the Rumble, felt like the first real step on that road to Miami. We had a fun open with some fresh faces, two really good matches, one of which even had some length to it, the beginnings of the Jericho-Punk feud, probably the best segment yet involving Kane and John Cena in their wretched storyline, the return of The Undertaker, the debut of The Underwig, and best of all, Johnny Ace's job was spared for at least one more week. He received a stay of execution thanks to The Undertaker interrupting his job evaluation. See, even the dead man enjoyed Johnny's run as the interim GM of Raw. He didn't want to see him go. That's why he came out. The Raw main event for the Elimination Chamber on February 19th was announced on this show. It will be CM Punk defending the WWE Championship against Chris Jericho, Dolph Ziggler, Kofi Kingston, The Miz, and R-Truth. I cannot remember the last time Miz actually won a match. And Ziggler already had a title shot, and he lost four times in the same match to CM Punk. So this notion that they somehow get a title shot on the very next pay-per-view, to me, illustrates why having two chamber matches makes absolutely no sense. I mean, every one of those challengers lost in the Royal Rumble match, and yet here they are receiving an automatic shot at the championship. I mean, it renders the Rumble completely meaningless. Oh, but Solomonster, it's not just the shot of the title that you win. You get to headline WrestleMania by winning the Royal Rumble. Oh, really? When was the last time the Rumble winner actually headlined WrestleMania? As in, competed in the final match on the card. Randy Orton in 2009. And before that, Batista, way back in 2005. I mean, just have Sheamus announce the day after the Rumble which title he's going for, or better yet, don't even give him the option and just make it whatever title is represented by the brand that he's on. And then just have one chamber match for the other championship. Is that so hard? It's like having two Money in the Bank matches on the same show. It's complete overkill, and it makes titles mean nothing. Speaking of Money in the Bank, it appeared that that pay-per-view was back on the schedule for July. I believe it still is. Which, if that's the case, you would think would mean no Money in the Bank match at WrestleMania, but apparently there's some talk they may do a Money in the Bank match anyway on the WrestleMania show involving only former world champions, which basically means they're going to do a regular Money in the Bank match, because let's be honest, everybody is a former world champion. Jack Swagger is a former world champion. Dolph Ziggler is a former world champion. I may be a former world champion. I have to go back and check my my schedule here. Maybe perhaps I was in a match I'm unaware of. I think everybody has held the championship at least once. So essentially, they're going to do a Money in the Bank match at WrestleMania, and then a couple of months later, they're going to turn around and do two more. You tell me that's not overkill. Give me a break. SmackDown Chamber, by the way, will have Daniel Bryan defending the World Heavyweight title against the great Khali, who is replacing an injured Mark Henry. So the best they could come up with is the great Khali. You know what? Put Drew McIntyre in there. Drew McIntyre is fired. He's the best employee fired man I've ever seen in my life. Put him in there. Drew McIntyre actually got over in the Elimination Chamber last year. Remember that? He was in one of the chamber matches, and he actually came in. He came out of the pod, and he beat the shit out of people. He was kicking ass. I think people were cheering him at one point. He got over in that match. I'd rather see Drew McIntyre in there. Why the great Khali? I'm not even sure the great Khali is going to fit in one of the pods. He'll have to start the match. I can't picture him in one of those pods having to bend over, you know, hunched over until his turn comes. I mean, geez, poor guy. Big Show's in there as well. Cody Rhodes, Wade Barrett, and Randy Orton. So there you go. That's the Elimination Chamber announcements. Now, let's get on to this show, which I actually very much enjoyed. I really like the opening segment with Laryngitis shaking hands with the fans and the workers by the ringside area. He just had this disingenuous smile from ear to ear. And he said he was looking forward to his performance review with Triple H because he knows he's done a good job. He said he's made some mistakes, but everyone makes mistakes, so you can't fault him for that, which is true. Then he did something that I loved, and I've advocated for this before. This is just common sense here. I hate it whenever they announce matches spur of the moment on the show, like at the top of the show, or they do those segments where one guy comes out, another guy comes out, another guy comes out, another guy comes out, and then, oh, well, let's just make a fatal four-way involving all of you. You know, as though they're actually going to go live on the air with millions of people watching without having a main event already set. So this time, Laryngitis came out and he ran down the entire card for the evening. He didn't wait for people to come down and interrupt him. He just said, tonight we're going to have a Divas Championship match between Beth Phoenix and Eve Torres. We're going to have Kofi Kingston against The Miz. We're going to have Dolph Ziggler against Randy Orton. And for the first time ever, in WWE anyway, Daniel Bryan would battle CM Punk in a champion against champion showdown. You know, if you're going to continue this tired GM gimmick that they've had for years and years and years, this is how it should be used. Have the guy come out at the beginning of the show, cut to him in his office in the back, whatever you want to do. Stephanie McMahon also, when she was the GM on SmackDown back in 2002-2003, she also would do that. They would go to her in her office backstage for this, you know, promo at the top of the show, and she would run down all the matches that night. That's how these people should be used. If you do that, then fine. I am fine with having a general manager of the show whose purpose exists merely to let us know who is fighting that night. And then they go away, and we watch matches. That's the way wrestling should be. I like this. CM Punk came out, interrupted Laryngitis by singing the goodbye song to him. And Punk generally acted like a dick here, which probably isn't too far off from how he is in real life. Laryngitis said that he would not take anything personally. He suggested they put their differences aside. He offered his hand. Punk, of course, declined and threatened him, acting like a dick yet again. Daniel Bryan came out, went back and forth on the mic with Punk, and for anyone who knows their history outside of WWE, this was quite the segment to observe here. This was very, very cool stuff. Bryan called himself a role model and a vegan. Punk called himself the best wrestler in the world, which is actually a ripoff of Daniel Bryan's own catchphrase when he was in Ring of Honor. Sheamus came out to a big-time reaction, reminded everybody, hey, I'm still here. He said that he won the Royal Rumble 24 hours ago. He would challenge for one of their titles at WrestleMania, and then he left. And I don't remember if we saw him again for the rest of the show. Punk and Bryan actually shook hands to close out the segment, and for a while, Code of Honor was actually trending on Twitter. Oddly enough, WWE did not put a box up on the screen telling us this. I can't imagine why not. By the way, was I the only one who noticed the use of Kane's original theme music while they were showing those still shots of the match with him and Cena from the Rumble? I picked up on that right away. I am a big fan of that theme song. It's still his best theme, in my opinion. One of the best in WWE history, in fact, is that original Kane music. So I thought that was a cool thing. Randy Orton and Dolph Ziggler, as they always tend to do, had a really good match. Ziggler had a bounce-back performance after that disappointing match with Punk the night before. Orton and Ziggler worked very well together. I also really liked Josh Matthews interviewing Wade Barrett up in the skybox prior to and during the match. It just felt different. You know, it also helps that Barrett is such a smooth talker. He's so natural on the microphone. Orton wins clean with an RKO, and since he just returned and was heading into a big match with Barrett this week on SmackDown, it was the right outcome. But again, I question putting Ziggler in that situation at all. Even though we got a great match out of it, Ziggler has not been made to look very strong lately. Although, I guess by WWE standards, he's going to win the World Championship then at Elimination Chamber if that's the case. So if that's the case, good for him. TMZ first broke the news on Monday morning, then WWE made it official on this show that Iron Mike Tyson will be inducted into the celebrity wing of the WWE Hall of Fame March 31st in Miami. I am actually fine with this. If you're going to have a celebrity wing, you have to have Mike Tyson in there. In fact, the only celebrity who deserves to be in there more than Mike Tyson would be Mr. T, who doesn't want to go in. Both guys actually meant big business for WWE, and they were proven draws for the company when they were used. In fact, you can make the argument that without Mr. T being at WrestleMania 1, the first WrestleMania may have been a flop. And if that show flops, we may not be sitting here today talking about WWE. So for that reason alone, he deserves to go in. With Tyson, his involvement came at a time when WWE was playing second fiddle to WCW every week. That angle on Raw where he shoved Steve Austin got an incredible amount of publicity for the company. And Tyson's involvement at WrestleMania 14 did big business and helped turn it helped turn that company's fortunes around. I wouldn't play the Mr. T card and say that, you know, WWE would have gone under without Mike Tyson's involvement, because they would not have. But it was a turning point for them, and it gave their top draw, Steve Austin, a ton of rub, a ton of credibility. He launched himself into the stratosphere after that. not because of Mike Tyson, but I'm sure Tyson's involvement with him certainly didn't hurt. And the other thing also is Mike Tyson is a huge wrestling fan, which, as I've said before, when it comes to these celebrities and athletes, it's something I can appreciate as a fan when I can tell that they're a real fan and they're not just faking it. You know, as opposed to somebody like Drew Carey, who seems like a nice enough guy, but looked like he would rather be anywhere else in the world when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame last year. So, Iron Mike going into the Hall of Fame March 31st, very cool. My favorite Raw superstar, Mr. Brodus Clay, beat Tyler Rex. Tyler Rex actually got about 5 seconds of offense in on the big man here before getting killed. WWE has added a giant disco ball to the Brodus Clay act, which hangs above the ring when he comes out. He's going to have to face somebody a little bit higher up on the card soon, but for now, this is okay, him squashing guys. I mean, it's been a while since we've seen somebody debut and actually rack up a bunch of wins and be made to look strong as opposed to debuting and either losing in their very first match or facing upper mid-card guys right out of the gate. I think Gene Snitsky, actually, when he debuted on Raw, his first match was against Kane, although I guess that was part of the storyline where Gene Snitsky hit Kane with a chair, I think, and Kane fell on top of Lita, and she miscarried her child. And boy, Kane has had some pretty shitty storylines. I mean, when you really stop and think about it, my God. I mean, between that stuff and the Katie Vick stuff and this bullshit, and there was another storyline also he was involved in that escapes me at the moment. But he's been involved in some really bad stuff over the course of his career. Anyway, I'm going off track here. Daniel Bryan and CM Punk had an excellent match at the top of the hour. They had a great match, and really, what a difference a year makes. I was thinking about this. 1 year ago, almost to the day on this very show, Edge had a match against The Miz. It was a champion-against-champion match that, if I recall correctly, wasn't very good and had very little heat. And here, the crowd certainly got into it more as the match wore on, and we were treated to a far better wrestling match. With two world-class performers. No offense to Edge, but before he even announced his retirement, I spoke on the sound off about how tired he looked, about how broken down he appeared to be. So Edge was not at his finest in early 2011. But anyway, these two guys here, they had a classic wrestling battle. I mean, it harkened back to their matches in Ring of Honor, for those of you who have seen it. A lot of stiff kicks, a lot of submission-style maneuvers that the fans were getting into. You know, that they never chanted boring or anything like that. Punk even busted out the top rope Hurricanrana, which I don't think I've seen him do since the match with Cena at Money in the Bank last year. So you could tell he was turning it up a notch here. They gave them a lot of time, too. I didn't clock it, but it had to be close to 15 minutes or so. And in the end, Chris Jericho ran down to the ring and attacked Daniel Bryan. He threw him into the barricade on the outside. Then he went into the ring and gave the code breaker to CM Punk. Referee called for the DQ and awarded the match to Daniel Bryan, who again celebrated like he just won the Super Bowl. Not going to complain about the DQ finish here because it would not have been right to beat either guy in this scenario. You know, Punk can't be beat here. Daniel Bryan shouldn't be beat here. And, you know, we finally got the first seed planted for the feud between CM Punk and Chris Jericho. It wouldn't shock me at all to actually see Jericho win the championship at Elimination Chamber, so Punk goes into WrestleMania as the challenger instead, chasing for the title, which is probably how it should be going into the biggest show of the year. So this was great stuff. I love this. Miz lost to Kofi Kingston, and I'd say it sucks to be Miz these days, but that SOB is dating Maryse, so really it can't suck all that much to be him. I did think it was a good little match, though. I'm putting it in the good category. What I really liked was Kofi winning clean with an awesome-looking Trouble in Paradise kick. Again, Kofi got fucked over by Evan Bourne's suspension, so it's nice to see him get a clean win on Raw for a change. R-Truth was gold on commentary during this segment, and he did say he considered himself to be done with The Miz. He was moving on to other challenges. And why shouldn't he? You know, he beat Miz clean on the show the week before. He should be done with him. After the Divas match, which was not good, and I'll get to that in a second, we had Kane on the Titantron, threatening to make an example out of poor Eve and to continue killing her boyfriend, Zack Ryder, until John Cena embraced the hate. And with this whole Cena-Ryder thing, I keep going back to that one scene in the first Die Hard movie where John McClane is hiding somewhere in Nakatomi Tower and the terrorists are threatening to kill people unless he shows his face, and McClane basically just refuses to give himself up and he lets them shoot Ellis in the head when, in theory, he could have tried to save him. I liken that to what John Cena is doing to his supposed best friend here. He refuses to embrace the hate. And as a result, Zack Ryder, I guess, has been rendered immobile, I guess. I mean, he had a broken back, which then turned out to only be a herniated disc, but still, he showed up at the Rumble in a wheelchair wearing a back brace. Then he gets tombstoned, which in the world of WWE probably means he suffered a broken neck. I mean, can the guy even move his eyebrows and feed himself at this point? And if not, what a cruel joke on him. After chasing Eve all those weeks, he finally convinces her to go on a date with him, and then that was the night that Kane killed him for the first time. Now this. This guy must have blue balls like nobody's business. Anyway, Kane magically appeared behind Eve, who fell to the canvas and began screaming in terror instead of, you know, rolling out of the ring. At this point, John Cena appeared for the first time on the entire show, which in and of itself I thought was a positive. Cena in small doses I can tolerate, so I'm not knocking the guy, just, you know, he's way overexposed. He ran to the ring, and I use the word ran loosely because I've come to realize that John Cena runs funny. Watch the next time that John Cena runs down to the ring, like really tries to run to the ring, and you'll laugh your ass off. It's high comedy. He went right after Kane. No silly comedy, just a giant brawl around ringside with Cena using the steel steps on Kane as a weapon several times. Then he teased putting him through the announce table before Kane bailed through the crowd. I actually thought this was the best Cena-Kane segment to date in this putrid storyline between the two of them. I mean, I hate it. It's still stupid, but Cena was full of fire and rage and showed great intensity here. And wouldn't you know that the crowd seemed to be quite a bit more behind John Cena on this show than other crowds have been of late? It's funny how that works, isn't it? When you don't overexpose a guy, and then when he finally does come out, you don't treat everything like a colossal joke. People tend to like that. That's a good strategy to try again in the future if I'm WWE. Johnny Ace came out for the final segment. He was on a roll here. He gave himself all perfect fives for his job performance on a scale of 1 to 5. Claiming that Raw's ratings are up under his watch from where they were a year ago, which is a lie. Triple H came out. He said that laryngitis has allowed personal issues to cloud his judgment. He did some comedy. He threatened to make him join the Triple H Kiss My Ass Club without actually calling it the Kiss My Ass Club. Laryngitis pulled out the chapstick, just like William Regal back in the day. He laid it on thick and was actually ready to go through with it. Hunter did not make him do it. What a horrible boss, by the way. Instead of just firing the guy and letting him leave with some dignity, he puts him through all of this. This all built up to Hunter. He was about to wish laryngitis well in his future endeavors, thus making me very, very sad when Undertaker's gong hit and the place went nuts. And I've never been a bigger Undertaker fan than I was here. Undertaker comes out to his old theme music, thank God. I like the Johnny Cash theme, but it served its purpose last year. He walked to the ring, and I immediately noticed that something was off about him. I mean, he appeared to have curly hair, which Undertaker has never had before. Somebody else pointed out that he had no sideburns to speak of either, which makes sense given that he shaved his head bald a couple of months ago. And at his age, that hair ain't growing back so quickly. Not to the length that it was at before. So he came into the ring, never took his hat off, and it was a gigantic hat at that. I think it was even larger than the usual fedoras that he wears. Basically, the Undertaker, the Dead Man, the Phenom, the Demon of Destruction, one of the toughest men to ever set foot inside of a WWE ring, was wearing a wig. He looked like Raggedy Ann out there with that curly hair. I just could not get over that. Some people, you know, some people could probably pull it off, but this was just so distracting. I thought maybe I was the only one who saw this. Of course, everybody always thinks, oh, am I the only one? You go online and you realize, no, you're in fact no more or less special than the next person. Everybody realized something was off about this. And anyway, Undertaker looked back at Triple H. He gave the throat slash, implying that we are in fact going to have a third chapter in the Undertaker Triple H Chronicles at WrestleMania. Because if there's one thing we need here, it is a rubber match to determine who is in fact the better man. Because after all, Undertaker won the first match, and Triple H, based on that promo he did all those weeks back, apparently thinks he won the second match. Just by virtue of Undertaker not being able to leave on his own 2 feet, he somehow broke the streak last year. So now we have to have a third match. It's just ridiculous. And I was a big fan of the Undertaker-Triple H match last year. I thought it was match of the year up until that John Cena-CM Punk match at Money in the Bank. Very, very good match. One of the better matches Undertaker has had in WrestleMania history. All those matches that he's had. Not as good as the Shawn Michaels ones, but still very, very good. I don't need to see this match a third time. I'm sure they'll tell a very nice story, and Shawn Michaels may be part of it somehow. He may be the referee. And then, you know, is Shawn going to side with his friend, or is he going to side with The Undertaker and make sure the streak stays intact? It's a nice little story, but it's a story that does not have to be told because it's a match we've already seen twice before. There's no reason for Triple H to be the only man ever in WrestleMania history to have three Mania matches with The Undertaker, as though there's any sort of dispute about who the better man is at WrestleMania. Undertaker beat his ass twice. Why do we need a third match? It doesn't make any sense, but it's Triple H, and he wants the match, and so there you go. So whatever. I'm sure it'll be a good match. That'll be the saving grace, but it's kind of disappointing that after all these years, he's going to go 20-0. It's a big deal, and it's Triple H. It's just, you know, I don't know. I still like my original idea of making Randy Orton his opponent instead, especially with Orton being the odd man out right now, because, you know, I'm sure he'll work his way into the world title match somehow, but right now, Randy Orton does not have a clear-cut WrestleMania match. You know, and even though he had the match back at WrestleMania 21 with Undertaker, that was a very different Randy Orton. The Randy Orton of 2005, very, very different than the Randy Orton of 2012. I would be okay with doing that match again, and I think it would be a hell of a match. And you know, it's just like this one, you know, babyface against babyface, so the dynamic is the same. I stick with my original idea. They haven't convinced me yet that they've come up with a better one. I think Orton would have been a good opponent for The Undertaker, but that's not going to happen. Triple H, he patted Undertaker on the shoulder like a son patting his elderly father on the shoulder after he just wet himself. And then he walked to the back. So how does Undertaker react to this development? He seeks guidance from the greater power that is the WrestleMania 28 sign. That damn sign has only been back for 48 hours. And in those 48 hours, they've already managed to overdo it with the pointing and the staring. I'm going to be at Sun Life Stadium in Miami for WrestleMania this year, which means that that sign is guaranteed to be hanging there. In fact, I'm going to be sitting pretty high up in that stadium, quite possibly on the same side as that sign. If I can get close enough to it, I might just have to take matters into my own hands. I need some time to think about what I might do here to this sign at WrestleMania. So I'll let you know. Having said all of that, I actually did like this segment. I mean, having Undertaker back adds more star power to WrestleMania. The fans seem to enjoy it. I did too. Wig and all. The bad. Let's talk about the bad here. There really is just one thing for me to comment on this week. If I have to mention something that really pissed me off, it was the match between Beth Phoenix and Eve going literally less than 30 seconds. I mean, their entrances individually were longer than the match itself. It was like the girls were at the gorilla position waiting to go out, and Billy Kidman, who handles all the time cues for the show, just looked up at them before they even walked out, told them to go home. Wouldn't shock me if it actually played out that way. I guess WWE would explain this by saying that Eve has been under a great deal of stress lately, and so therefore her head really wasn't in the game. Except, she started this match out as a house of fire, going nuts on Beth in the corner, and then Beth just beat her with the Glam Slam out of nowhere. And by the way, that Glam Slam move that Beth uses looks so weak. You know, the way she very slowly brings them down, she's got to change things up, or just, you know, speed up the delivery of the actual slam, or just pick a different move, because this one just does not look devastating at all. Maybe she can steal Victoria's old Widow's Peak move. See, that thing actually looked like it killed people, but it was pretty safe to perform if you knew what you were doing. You know, Victoria is a good worker, so she knew what she was doing. Beth is also one of the few divas left on the current roster who can actually work, so I say go for it. My guess is they're setting up for a Beth Phoenix Karma match at WrestleMania. At least I hope they are, because, I mean, that's the biggest divas match they could do right now. So that's a direction I think they should go in. But again, these 30s, I can't even believe they bothered sending them out there. I mean, they wanted to do the angle with Kane. So, literally, the only reason this match even existed was to enhance the John Cena-Kane storyline. And I just feel bad for the women. You know, I don't know why I do. I shouldn't let it bother me at this point, but it's a waste of television time. Why even bother sending them out there? It's just so fucking stupid. The ugly on this show, there was one thing in the ugly category, believe it or not, this week. William Regal revealed to Johnny Ace on this show that he has two daughters, conjoined twins, that he keeps locked up in his attic. Clearly, he's been taking parenting lessons from Paul Bearer. And that's Raw. Good show. Great show, in fact. This week, WWE launched their very own YouTube channel. On Wednesday was the official launch, and they have a whole bunch of shows up there. I think they're about 5 minutes each. There's one called WWE Download, which was hosted by Dolph Ziggler. There's a cooking show with the Usos. There's a Santino talk show called Foreign Exchange. Zack Ryder's YouTube show officially moved over to the WWE YouTube channel, which I feel kind of bad now. I mean, you know, before people could post comments under the video on YouTube for Ryder's videos. Now that it's under the WWE Fan Nation name on YouTube, WWE does not allow people to post comments on their videos for reasons that you could probably imagine. I'm sure they're terrified to have people react to some of the shit they put up there. But that means that nobody can comment on Zack Ryder's videos anymore, which is the first small sign of what happens when WWE kind of takes over things. I fear that over time, Zack's show is going to lose a lot of that luster that it's had up until this point. But, I mean, hell, if that's what happens, so be it. His show served a very specific purpose, which was to help save his job and get him over, and it worked. I mean, it really is a success story. USA Today had an article on Zack Ryder this week as well about his use of the internet, his use of video to help get himself over. It's a story that WWE probably wants to get out even more in the media. And it's a great story at that, but I think Zack's show may be... Maybe I'm being a little premature about this, but I think his show is on the downward spiral now that it's no longer independent and WWE took over. I worry about that. But I had a chance to watch three of the videos, so I'll just have some quick comments on the three that I actually watched. The Dolph Ziggler one was a complete waste of time. He talked about taint bruising your taint on this show. I cannot even believe that I'm saying this on my podcast right now. But he actually talked about this on his show. That right there tells you everything you need to know about that show. It's basically Dolph doing some scripted narrating over some funny YouTube clips. Who cares? You know, it's nothing special. I mean, Dolph has a very... he's got a nice personality. He's a very outgoing guy, very charismatic. You could do a lot of things with Dolph, and maybe the future editions of this will be funnier. Maybe it's the clips. Maybe I just didn't find them to be too funny. Maybe it's the scripting, since he's so obviously being scripted by WWE writers here. But whatever. This was nothing. Usos have a cooking show. And on this show, they cooked a traditional Samoan meal. They have to wear their traditional Samoan aprons when they cook, we learned. And they also use way too much mayo in this chicken dish that they put together. They literally had three humongous gobs of mayo that they just dumped into this pot. And I thought to myself, wow, no wonder the Samoans are so big. But when it was all said and done, the chicken they made actually looked pretty good, I will say. And you know what? Stuff like this is good for guys like Jimmy and Jay because it gives you an opportunity to learn a little bit more about themselves. You know, you're not going to see WWE put together a 3 or 4 minute video package on the Usos on SmackDown anytime soon. So it's an opportunity for them to show their personality, to learn a little bit more about them. I actually like this. I like this. And Santino's show called Foreign Exchange was also kind of weird. I didn't like this as much. I guess I was expecting it to be funnier since Santino is usually better with the comedy. The one thing about this segment is at one point he finds, I think it was Nikki Bella, who is playing a pinball machine backstage somewhere. And he has a very brief chat with Nikki, and they're talking. There's a lot of double entendres and, you know, sexual innuendo going on here. And Marcus on Facebook actually wrote to me and said, he said, "It looks like the comments about the Bella twins that you made on a recent Sound Off was true. Did you see the ball handling comment on Santino's Foreign Exchange?" In fact, I did. Santino commented on Nikki's great ball handling skills, which she did not disagree with. She, in fact, I think her response was something to the effect of, "How did you hear about that? Do I know what I'm talking about or what? Two whores these women are." Very attractive, but two whores nonetheless. So this was fine for what it was. Again, I haven't seen all the shows yet. It's fine. I mean, you know, the thing about this YouTube channel that could be of great benefit to them is that being that their new network is not launching until later this year, they can use it almost as a testing ground for new shows that may at some point appear on the WWE network. If I'm them, that's what I would use YouTube for, and I would enable comments on at least some of these videos to get feedback from people, although I guess doing that on YouTube, you're taking a risk. But, you know, for a company who loves to tout how interactive and fan-friendly they are, and social media this and social media that, and, you know, interact with us on Twitter and Facebook and now YouTube, I find it odd and rather peculiar that they would have comments disabled on their videos. I just think that's a bit hypocritical on their part, but what do I know? One more random WWE note here. This note actually comes from the recent Wrestling Observer newsletter. Kelly Kelly was ordered to attend driving school by a judge in Tampa after picking up several traffic citations for running red lights. And the first thought I had in my head when I read this was, apparently she runs red lights better than she runs the ropes. Poor girl looks absolutely terrified every time she goes to bounce off the ropes. Pay attention to that in the next Kelly Kelly match. A quick update on Sting's injury, which I mentioned last week. Sting suffered some sort of heel injury. He was in a match that I believe will air on Impact next week. It was a tag match, and I think he had Bobby Roode in the Scorpion Deathlock. Thought that he might have tore his Achilles tendon, which Sting did an interview this week with a radio station down in Orlando, and he even admitted that if it was an Achilles tendon tear or rupture or injury of some kind, his career was done. But apparently he thinks or was told that the injury was something related to the fascia, which is also down by the foot or the heel. He thought maybe he just tore the fascia, and apparently that's exactly what happened. He tore it off. Doctors said to him that he'll be out for about 4 to 6 weeks, although he's going to try to wrestle as early as next weekend, which, well, that's wrestler mentality there for you. Although I do question Sting at the age of 54 feeling the need to wrestle when he's hurt. You know, the older you get, the slower your body heals. I would take the doctor's advice in this case if I were him, but he's going to be back very soon. Thankfully, the injury could have been a lot worse, and his injury will not end his career, which would be a really shitty way, if you really think about it, for the career of Sting to come to an end on an Achilles injury, which is a really, really shitty injury. So he really dodged a bullet on that one. Speaking of TNA, I did not watch all of Impact. I did watch enough of it, though, to get a feel for the setting, the arena in London. I thought it was very well done in terms of the look. It looked like one of the biggest crowds TNA has ever performed in front of. I'm pretty sure the number of fans at the ballpark here in Brooklyn for the TNA shows that I've attended were actually bigger. At least the first show they had here in Brooklyn, I think, had between 5,500 and 6,000 fans. And I believe the show here in London had somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000. So, in fact, it was not the biggest TNA crowd of all time, but it still looked pretty impressive, and it's another illustration of why they've got to get the TV show out of that goddamn Impact Zone. You know, the location of the show has nothing to do with creative, so you can still have a shitty show, but taking it out of the Impact Zone just makes it feel so much more professional. It makes it feel like such a bigger deal than it actually is. Perception is reality, and I think as long as they stay in that Impact Zone in Orlando, the perception is going to be that they're a second-rate wrestling promotion, and that's something they need to avoid at all costs. You know, TNA is celebrating their 10-year anniversary this year, one of the most unlikely wrestling anniversaries, I think, in history. I will give them credit for sticking around and staying afloat as long as they have, but I also, as I've said before, realize that this company has a lot of work to do because they've been around for 10 years and I feel like they've reached a point a long time ago where they've plateaued. You know, their ratings will not go above a certain level. And they live and die by those TV ratings because of the deal with Spike, which is going to be expiring, I believe, later this year. And that's still a very big concern in TNA. They were really hoping that the show would do well. I believe the rating for the show was pretty much in line with what Impact has been doing. But part of the whole the whole idea of doing these tapings on the road is that Spike TV kicks in a lot of money for it. So they're kind of at the mercy of Spike TV. If Spike comes to them and says, listen, these shows are very expensive, especially the overseas shows that we just did, we're going to take the action back to Orlando for a couple of months, and then maybe we'll reconsider going back on the road. I hope that doesn't happen. I don't believe they have any other road tapings scheduled domestically any time in the near future. And that's a problem right there. I think TNA needs to get out more. This was a good first step. It looked very slick. It looked cool. It looked good. I can't say the same for the part of Impact that I saw with Eric Bischoff and his son. That bored me to tears, and I turned it off. But good job on that. They need to get out more and make a habit out of it. I know it's a costly endeavor, but I think in the end it'll be worth it. All right. Time to get back to the mailbag, the regular mailbag. We had the Facebook mailbag last week, and thank you to everybody who participated in that. We'll probably do another one sometime in the future. So again, if you want to get in on that, you got to friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSolomonster. You can also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Solomonster. And email me questions for the mailbag in the future, as always, to thesolomonster@gmail.com. I got a lot of good ones to go through this week, including some ones I had been hoping to get to last week, but did not. So let's dive right into it here. First question comes from Valentino from Scotland. Dear Solomonster, it would obviously not happen for a couple of years, but do you think Batista would be a big enough name to main event the Hall of Fame? He was a multiple-time world champion, Royal Rumble winner, and was probably one of the top three stars since the Attitude Era. There are obviously guys like Macho Man who are bigger and more deserving, but do you think Batista will eventually go in as the main event? No, I don't. I know Batista will go in at some point. He deserves to. But I don't know. You know, Batista was a very big name. I just have a problem seeing WWE headlining a main event class, a Hall of Fame class, I should say, with him as the main event. It's possible. I would say no. I think that when Batista goes in, I tend to think he'll go in with some other big name who will probably get top billing. You know, whether that's right or wrong, I mean, I'll leave that up to other people to decide. But I don't know. If I think he'll main event, yes or no, I would say no. I don't think he will. Neil from London writes in, Dear Solomonster, I've recently moved to Planet Funk. I've been a listener since episode 180, part of the Fatal 4-Way, and have left you a review on iTunes. My nickname is I Glow Blue on iTunes, so thank you to Neil for that. Says, congratulations on the 200 milestone. Two quick questions, first to do with Dolph Ziggler. I can't remember any major examples of a wrestler of Dolph's talents and status and storyline to successfully change their name. The only example I could think of is 123 Kid or Triple H, but that's just an acronym. I was wondering if there are any other examples and how you would go about changing his name. My second question was, because my 8-year-old nephew, who is a huge Hardy fan, has been asking me, where has Matt gone? And all the issues that TNA has brought up on television as it relates to Jeff. So far, I just say, I don't know. I'm grateful for any ideas for what I could say without just stating that Matt is insane and Jeff is a drug addict. Many thanks. Well, to your first question, you know, at this point, short of having Dolph come out and cut a promo about how dumb he thinks the name is, and calling himself Nick Nemeth, which is his real name, the best thing to do would be to just shorten his name to Dolph. You know, Rocky Maivia became The Rock. Hunter Hearst Helmsley became Triple H. Rikishi Fatu was shortened to just Rikishi. So you can get away with that. Although, I feel like at this point, the way he's been pushed as sort of a top guy, it would almost be funny if all of a sudden he changed his name. I think they've passed that point of no return where it would be very hard for them to change his name unless he disappeared for a very long time. If, God forbid, he got injured or something and he was out for 6 months. The only way to go about doing it, I think, would just be to shorten it to Dolph. You know, and no rhyme or reason, just have the announcers start calling him Dolph more often and eventually just drop the Ziggler name, because I still think Dolph Ziggler is a very silly name for a wrestler. And I think if Dolph Ziggler is, in fact, going to be that guy 2, 3, 4 years down the road, possibly headlining WrestleMania, as a heel champion against, you know, an up-and-coming guy, and you have Dolph Ziggler making the media rounds for WrestleMania on television and in newspapers, he's going to be the laughingstock of the entire world. And that's not right. And that's WWE's fault for giving him a shitty name in the first place. So I think that's really all you can hope for. As far as the second question is concerned, Matt and Jeff, you know, for Jeff, I would just tell your nephew that, yeah, he did some bad things that he shouldn't have done. He apologized. He made some mistakes. He got punished for it, and that's that. Now, with Matt, I would just tell him that, you know, Matt started playing a game of hide-and-go-seek with his brother, and nobody ever bothered telling him the game was over. And he's still hiding in the mountains of North Carolina. Do they even have mountains in North Carolina? I have no idea. Anyway, that's where he is. He's up in the mountains somewhere, still hiding. Nobody bothered to go tell him the game was over. It's like those Japanese soldiers from World War II, after the war had already ended. They were still hiding out in the jungle, wanting to kill Americans many years later. I picture Matt Hardy as a Japanese soldier. Dear Solomonster, I've been listening since episode 1, and besides Ring of Honor, your podcast is still the best wrestling program of all media. Well, thank you for that. Would it help TNA's ratings if they brought ad time, or bought ad time, I should say, during the Hall of Fame program to promote that the only place to watch 2-time Hall of Famer Ric Flair is on Impact Wrestling? That question comes from Lee West. I think that's a great idea, and I think TNA should look into that. It's not going to make a damn bit of difference. It's going to take a lot more than that to get people to watch TNA's show. TNA did that during Raw back in the day, if you remember, when they tried the Monday Night Experiment. They bought ad time on some cable stations anyway, and were airing Impact commercials during Raw, which I thought was genius on their part. Long term, it didn't do anything for them, but absolutely. I mean, if they work out a deal, or even if they don't, and Ric Flair is going to be at the Hall of Fame, I think TNA should jump all over that shit and take advantage of it and let people know that if you want to see more of the Nature Boy, tune into Spike TV every Thursday night. I think it makes sense. I think it's the only thing for them to do. This question comes from Rob, who listened to an interview recently with Brutus the Barber Beefcake. He had talked about the differences between today's wrestlers and the wrestlers of his time, and the differences, you know, back then they had a lot less restrictions placed upon them in terms of their character and their promos and stuff. Now everything is so, held very tightly and scripted and whatnot. And Rob's question is, why did Vince McMahon, what prompted him to suddenly change the way he developed and managed wrestlers and suddenly adopting his, quote, assembly line, as Beefcake calls it, mentality to create new superstars? I can't imagine the PG rating had something to do with it since PG was around during Beefcake's day. Was there something about the Attitude Era that encouraged him to place new restrictions on his workers? Because it seems like it was only after that that he adopted this philosophy. To that, I would say, you know, the desire to get away from old school wrestling booking and make his television more episodic in nature to compete with other shows on TV, that right there would be the biggest reason why Vince decided to do what he did. That coupled with wanting and recruiting new sponsors, which was a big reason for the PG turn. Because remember, you know, kids are but a fraction of their actual audience. The PG turn had more to do with sponsors than anything else. I think the median age for a Monday Night Raw viewer in 2012 is actually close to 40 years old. It's like 38 or something like that. That's the average age of a Raw viewer. It's not 12. It's not 17. It's almost 40. So that right there tells you what the PG term was really all about. But those would be the primary reasons for it right there. I think that right there sums it up in a nutshell. Dear Solomonster, I love the sound off. Keep up the good work. I got two quick questions. I was watching the best of Monday Nitro, and I remember DDP saying that Bill Goldberg was as big as Steve Austin back in 1998-99. Do you think an Austin vs. Goldberg match at the peak of their career would have sold more pay-per-views than a Steve Austin vs. Mike Tyson match? Goldberg putting his undefeated streak and world title on the line against pretty much the baddest man on the planet in Stone Cold and his WWE Championship. This comes from Tuneshi from the Bronx. You know, obviously we would never, ever in a million years see Goldberg as the WCW champion against Steve Austin as the WWF champion. Would a Austin vs. Goldberg match have sold more pay-per-views back then than Austin vs. Tyson? Not even close. Not even close. Austin vs. Goldberg would have done tremendous business. I still remember Bill Goldberg going on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno at the behest of Eric Bischoff, I'm sure, and actually issuing a challenge, putting up money to challenge Steve Austin to a match, which I thought was just the dumbest thing that you could possibly do. Because, you know, they're two separate companies. Austin would never be allowed to do anything or to respond even if he wanted to. And I think WWE pretty much ignored it, as they should have, and Goldberg looked like a fool. But the match, if you ever were able to put that match together, it would have done tremendous business on pay-per-view. But you have to understand something, that back in the day, Mike Tyson was the pay-per-view draw. He was, I think, the first big pay-per-view draw ever. I mean, now you've got guys like Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao, and before he retired, to a lesser extent, Brock Lesnar, at his peak, was a big pay-per-view draw as well. He was a very big part of why UFC 100 did over a million and a half pay-per-view buys, which I don't know that any UFC show ever again is going to come close to that number. Tyson was the first. People wanted to see Mike Tyson fight, even if it wasn't a big marquee fight like Tyson Holyfield. They wanted to see Mike Tyson fight. And to put Mike Tyson in the ring, granted it's not a boxing match, but to put him in the ring with Steve Austin, who was already becoming, if not one of the biggest stars in wrestling, Tyson, who was this big proven pay-per-view draw, and even as an enforcer, I mean, he really did help that WrestleMania 14 buy rate, that would have blown any Goldberg versus Austin match clear out of the water. I mean, there's no comparison between the two. That if they would have gone with Austin versus Tyson as a match at WrestleMania 14, you would have probably at least doubled that buy rate. Whatever they did for Austin versus Michaels, they would have at least doubled it had they done Austin versus Tyson. So, I mean, there really is no comparison. Mario writes in from Egypt, a very late congratulations on reaching 200 episodes. I have a question. I got the WWE All-Stars video game, and when I saw what they got for Fantasy Warfare, I instantly remembered you in that episode you talked about with your dream matches. I believe you're referring to episode 26, which I think was the first special sound-off I ever did. But anyway, Mario continues here. I don't know if you checked it out, but there are some really good matches on this game, like Ultimate Warrior against Sheamus, John Morrison against Randy Savage, Edge versus Bret Hart, and of course John Cena versus Hulk Hogan. I can run you the whole list. What do you think of these matches? Honestly, you know, of those matches that you mentioned, I think the best match would be Savage in his prime against John Morrison. Now, I never criticized John Morrison's in-ring ability, just his promo ability. I thought John Morrison was a hell of a wrestler. I think that'd be a hell of a match. John Morrison against Randy Savage in his prime. Bret Hart versus Edge would be good, too. But honestly, when I think of Fantasy Warfare, matches Bret Hart could have had had he not been injured, had he not retired early, Edge is not the first name that comes to mind. Kurt Angle would come to mind. Chris Jericho would come to mind. Daniel Bryan would come to mind before I would ever consider Edge against Bret Hart. This letter comes from Rodrigo. He says, it's clear that English-speaking WWE fans are not happy about commentary from Michael Cole. Well, let me tell you that we, the Hispanic fans, have our own Spanish commentators. They used to be Carlos Cabrera and Hugo Savinovich, and those guys were amazing. They commented in a very objective way. They named the grapples and constantly made references to old matches, so they gave the product the feeling that we were watching actual sport. Well, those days are gone. Now we have two guys that really suck. They follow the typical pattern of the face-heel commentators, but it's quite difficult to believe them. So I think that Vince is definitely trying to kill off the product, or at least the love that we have for it. I can't figure out why. Anyway, he says, I watched a series of videos on YouTube called Reasons Why WCW Failed. If you haven't watched them, I recommend you do so. There was a match between Bill Goldberg and Kevin Nash in which Goldberg blocked the jackknife attempt and simply walked away just to have Vince Russo yell at him in front of the audience. What exactly happened there? If it was part of a storyline, it looks stupid since Goldberg was the face. I'm 100% oblivious about the context of this match. Well, Vince Russo was involved, so you could probably figure it out on your own. Basically, it was not a shoot. It was meant to be a shoot. It was Vince Russo trying to pretend that they were shooting to stir up some controversy. I remember that show. I don't know that it was a singles match. There may have been, Scott Steiner may have been involved in that match. It may have been a triple threat, but I remember Goldberg blocked the jackknife and he simply walked off. And I remember on commentary, I think it was Tony Schiavone and Mark Madden, I think were on commentary. Maybe Scott Hudson was as well. And they were, I believe, talking about how he just went against the script. Goldberg just went against the script. Oh my God. How dare he? What's going to happen now? I could tell you that when I watched this for the first time on YouTube, because I didn't watch it live, because by that point WCW was unwatchable to me. But when I saw this for the first time, I literally had goosebumps on my skin. Not goosebumps in the good way, like you get excited about something. I got goosebumps on my skin because I was so embarrassed to be watching this that I almost vomited. I mean, I literally almost got physically ill watching this because you watch something like that and that illustrates perfectly why Vince Russo's brand of pro wrestling sucks. Because to him, well, you know, we got to make it more like reality TV here. Oh my God, this guy's breaking the script. This fake wrestling show is being ruined by this guy who's walking out on the script. What's going to happen now? How will these guys improvise for the rest of the match? It's just complete fucking bullshit. There was no context to it. That was the context. It was supposed to be a shoot. Nobody knew what the hell was going on. The commentators did an absolutely, I guess, I was going to say horrendous, but I guess they did an absolutely fantastic job of making wrestling seem and sound as fake can possibly be. And it was absolutely one of the examples of why WCW died a death. There's a lot of reasons why WCW died. That right there, you know, is a microcosm of why. There were other instances where, you know, Russo would try to book shoots and stuff like that, but this right here took the cake. This was atrocious. So I would actually tell people, if you've never seen it before, to find it. Go ahead and find it on YouTube. I want you to watch it and let me know what reaction to it you had. It was one of those reactions where not only did I feel like vomiting out of anger, but I felt like I wanted to put my head down and cover my face. And I'm sitting here in my room by myself. There's nobody else around, but I'm embarrassed to be sitting here watching this. Vince Russo has a tendency to book television like that. If there's one thing he's good at, it's making you embarrassed to be a wrestling fan. It's making you embarrassed to be watching whatever it is that's on your screen. And for all the hits that Russo may take credit for, and he had some good stuff, he had some good ideas, he had a lot of bad ideas. The bad ideas far outnumber the good ideas, especially outside of WWF. At least in WWF, he had a filter in Vince McMahon. Vince McMahon never would have ever allowed something like that on his television show. But in WCW, they thought Russo was Jesus Christ himself coming down for the resurrection. He can do no wrong. Let's put our product in this man's hands. Guess what? That company went out of business. There's a reason for that. Blackleg from the Philippines writes in, great to be part of Sound Off 200, so thank you for that. Being constantly bombarded by these incredibly unfunny fortune teller Santino Royal Rumble video promos, wow, that was long, just made me realize how these videos had declined greatly in quality. For the same pay-per-view, they had a nice subway train scuffle back in 2008, a great gladiator-themed advertisement back in 2006 with the McMahons, that awesome West Side Story-like promo for the Rumble in 2005. What the hell happened to these types of pay-per-view trailers? I really enjoy them. I think you can conjure up more hype and have more people interested if they produce these videos more like movie trailers rather than weak TV ads. For example, see the TLC commercial with David Otunga. I think these combined with lazy-ass posters and lackluster go-home shows contribute greatly to the slow death of the pay-per-view business. Is this a case of them running out of ideas or creative just being tardy? I don't think it's either one. I think it's them trying to cut costs. You know, it takes a lot of money to put together a production like that West Side Story ad. And I just think they were not interested in putting a lot of money into their pay-per-view commercial for the Royal Rumble. So they put a stupid hat on Santino's head, a fortune teller hat, and that was the commercial. And, you know, the first time I watched it, it was okay. It wasn't overly funny, but it was nice for a quick chuckle. And then I started seeing it again and again and again, and it got unfunnier, less funny, I should say, each time. So I agree. I mean, the pay-per-view ads now are not they're not as entertaining as they used to be, but to say that that's the reason why the pay-per-view business is declining, you know, is to not have a grasp on the real problem here. One doesn't have anything to do with the other. It really doesn't. The reason the pay-per-view business is going down has nothing at all to do with Santino's fortune teller commercial as compared to the ones they did 5 years ago. There's a lot of other reasons for it that I've already talked about, but I don't think that has anything to do with it, nor do I think it's an issue of creative. Like I said, I think it's an issue of cost. Second part of Blackleg's question here, what's your favorite pay-per-view video promo? I have always thought that the WrestleMania 21 movie parodies were the best. Many superstars shined on those, such as JBL, Big Show, even John Cena and Michael Cole. I specifically love the Taxi Driver parody. What do you think? Those WrestleMania 21 trailers were probably some of the best trailers or advertisements of their type for any WrestleMania ever. I love them. In fact, one of my favorite ones was the Undertaker Dirty Harry spoof. I'm a big fan of the original Dirty Harry. I'm a big fan of the Dirty Harry series, actually. And that spoof from the first movie where, you know, the guy is on the ground reaching for the gun and the Undertaker is, ironically, the Undertaker is wearing a wig. Surprise, surprise. In this promo, although his wig in this commercial was much cooler than the one he wore on Monday. And he's playing the Clint Eastwood role, and he walks over, and he says, you know, you feel lucky, punk. And I just thought that. And then at the very end of the commercial, when it looks like he's going to let the guy off, and the guy makes some sort of comment, calls him a son of a bitch, I think, Undertaker turns back around, and then he rolls the eyes. He rolls the pupils back inside his head like the real Undertaker. And then off-screen, you hear a gunshot go off. That, to me, was my favorite movie trailer. The Triple H Braveheart one, I thought, was also really funny, especially with Ric Flair in there and the donkey. So they did some really, really cool stuff with that, I have to be honest with you. Those were some of the best. In terms of other pay-per-view promos, one of my favorite ones was, I want to say, from the Breakdown pay-per-view, which was September of 1998. I think it was a Breakdown in Your House. It was the Mr. McMahon Utopia promo. You know, you must conform. Welcome to Mr. McMahon's Utopia. It was a really well done intro for the pay per view. But that's more. I guess that's more of a pay per view intro. It's not so much a video promo. But just throwing it out there for you. That's one of my favorites. If you've never seen it, I don't know if it's on YouTube anywhere. I think I searched for it once and I couldn't find it. But that's something for you to look for. Next question here comes from Brandon from New Jersey. Been listening to the show since episode 157. I'm also a member of the, he says, insert adjective for. It's the Fantastic Four, smartass. I've been looking up interviews with Jason Sensation about his problems with WWE management. I've come across many rumors that he was sexually assaulted by Kevin Fertigue, known as Mordecai or Kevin Thorne, and that WWE management told him to be lucky that Undertaker or JBL didn't do it to him. If this is true, do you think sexual assault and rape still occurs backstage in WWE? Also, on an unrelated note, why is there a lot of Daniel Bryan hate in the internet wrestling community right now that he's champion, but in 2010, it was a whole different story? Your first question, it's impossible for me to know. I have no idea if people are getting raped backstage in WWE. I don't think so. In fact, I'm almost positive it's not happening on any sort of large scale, or else we would hear about it. It's a very different backstage environment now than it was even 10 years ago, let alone 20 or 30 years ago. So my inclination would be to say no, but I haven't been back there showering. I haven't dropped the soap anytime recently, so I honestly don't know, and I don't want to know. As for the second question here, regarding the Daniel Bryan hate, I'm actually glad you brought that up, because it's a funny thing with the internet wrestling fans. Again, everybody knows they're very hard to please. It's almost impossible to please all of the internet wrestling fans, no matter what you do. Even when you do something they want you to do, they'll find fault with it. It's just the way it is. Daniel Bryan's getting a lot of that hatred right now. People, I think, in some cases are more upset with how he's being booked. But there's a lot of people out there that just don't like him, who did like him 2 years ago. And all of a sudden they think, oh my God, Daniel Bryan, he's overrated, he's this, he's that. And it's funny because the same thing happened with Sheamus. In fact, the same thing is happening with Sheamus right now. Sheamus had a lot of big-time supporters. Sheamus won the Royal Rumble. I've seen a lot of Sheamus hate. A lot of people hating on Sheamus. A lot of people hating on Sheamus because he's Triple H's buddy, which is true. And it may well have had something to do with why he won the Rumble. But to me, Sheamus is a good enough performer on his own where I don't mind that he won the Royal Rumble. He deserves it. He's one of the top babyfaces left on SmackDown. And he's pretty good in the ring. He's not a mat tactician like a CM Punk or a Daniel Bryan, but he's fine. I got no problem with Sheamus, but there's a lot of people hating on him. There's a lot of people hating on CM Punk as well. CM Punk was the internet wrestling darling, especially last summer. He could do no wrong. He was the man. He was the number one guy. And when he came back and he won the championship again and he really solidified himself as a main eventer, that's when I started in the fall. That's when I started to see the hatred for CM Punk rising and rising and rising. And it's just a funny thing. It's one of those things where people want you to get over. When you finally get over, their perception of you is that, well, now you're just one of them. Now you're just conforming to the system. You're part of the system. CM Punk, he said he was going to change this and he was going to change that, and he didn't. He didn't change the way the WWF belt looked. He didn't do all the things that he said he was going to do and make things interesting again. So he's just one of Vince McMahon's lackeys. He's one of his puppets, and so therefore we have to hate on him. And I think Daniel Bryan is getting some of that now as well. Best wrestler in the world. A lot of people liked him. A lot of people thought he was a funny guy, great wrestler. And now they look at him and they say, well, you know, Daniel Bryan's not having the same kind of matches he had in Ring of Honor or in Dragon Gate or any of the places he wrestled. He's just like any other WWE guy now. Well, of course he's just like any other WWE guy. He's in WWE, dumbass. What do you expect him to be? Do you really think they're going to let Daniel Bryan go out there and call his own matches and have Ring of Honor type matches on TV every week? Of course not. He's under the same time constraints and the same creative control that everybody else is under. He's doing pretty well for himself right now, all things considered. Him and Punk both, they're both world champions on their respective brands. They're both making a hell of a lot more money than they ever did before. But I guess to some people, they've sold out. It was just like when people would leave ECW back in the day, the original ECW, and you know, in some cases, maybe they really did sell out for the almighty dollar. Mike Awesome went to WCW, and you know, they made him Fat Chick Thriller. But I never begrudged anybody because they would leave ECW to go to WCW or WWF. They wanted to make a good living for themselves. Paul Heyman couldn't pay them a decent wage, maybe, and so they wanted to go make more money. There's nothing wrong with that, but all these people would chant, you sold out, you sold out. And it's kind of the same thing now. It's the modern-day adaptation of you sold out, only now people can hide behind their keyboard. They don't have to go down to the show and chant that. They can go on a message board. They can go on the SC Scoops website, and they could post comments like that and hide behind their computer because, you know, nobody's going to call them out on their bullshit. You know, somebody's not going to say to them, well, why? Why'd they sell out? Why do you all of a sudden have such hatred? I bet they won't have a legitimate answer because there is no legitimate answer. You either like Daniel Bryan, you either like CM Punk, or you don't. How do you like somebody and all of a sudden you turn against them? Is it because Daniel Bryan is a heel on television? I don't think that has anything to do with it. I think it's a bunch of people who don't know what they want, quite frankly. You can't please everybody. Gary from Virginia writes in, I just got finished reading a report that Dean Ambrose and Seth Rollins have guaranteed spots on the main roster. They just haven't been called up yet because of a new decree by Triple H that states he wants them to have a solid storyline and a strong gimmick before being brought up. Do you think this decree will be more helpful because it decreases the likelihood they'll be underutilized, or more hurtful because the creative team hasn't exactly been producing much quality lately? Thanks for everything you do. Keep up the awesome work. I think it's a little bit of both. You know, if it forces them to come up with creative characters or long-term plans for both guys, that's a great thing. You know, on the flip side, if creative has nothing for them, they may never get on TV, which is also a big problem. I mean, if your whole future is dependent upon creative coming up with a great idea for you, it may be a while before we see these guys. But I'll go out on a limb here. I will predict that we will see Dean Ambrose on Raw or SmackDown, probably Raw, shortly after WrestleMania. How soon after, I don't know. Maybe the next night, maybe within a month or two. But I do think he'll be up before Rollins, and I think it'll be a few more months, and I think we're going to see Dean Ambrose on TV. He's impressed a lot of people. He impressed a lot of people with that CM Punk match he had several months back when Punk, on his day off, went down to FCW and had an impromptu match with Ambrose. It was a great match. It was up on YouTube. I don't know if maybe it was taken down by now, but I mean, that right there was a great example of what Dean Ambrose can do. You know, go back and YouTube John Moxley matches, which was his name on the independents. He's a great performer, and he has that personality. Almost, he seems very far out there. He almost seems like a Brian Pillman type character to me. Something about him, that's a good thing because it sets him apart from everybody else. And I think that's part of what they like about him. He's a guy who can work, who can also probably do a character, whatever character they give him, very well. You know, he doesn't, you know, it's not as though he's nervous to be on TV or he's not very good at promos. He's already got all that down pat. So I think he's pretty much at the top of their developmental list. So whenever the time is right, the very next guy that comes up, I think, is going to be him. And I've said to other people who have asked me about Dean Ambrose before, he's going to have a good year. Once he comes up here in 2012 in the next couple of months, I see big things in his future. I really do. So watch for him. Luis from Illinois writes in, how much do you think WWE takes into account the traditional TV sweeps months of February, May, and November? Do they just take their orders from Bonnie Hammer whenever she asks for a three-hour Raw to jack up quarterly ratings? Yes. Yes, they do. Whenever Bonnie Hammer says, I want a three-hour Raw show, Vince McMahon has to do it. I don't think he's ever said no. And Vince McMahon himself has said before, the ideal length of a wrestling show, the ideal length of Raw, would be 90 minutes. So I'm sure that whenever Bonnie Hammer comes to him and says, we need another three-hour show, he's probably banging his head on the table, because then they have to come up with some sort of gimmick for the show. They have to book a three-hour wrestling show, in some cases, as the go-home show to a three-hour pay-per-view. That's happened a lot. In fact, I think that last Raw before Survivor Series might have been a three-hour Raw show as well. So, at the end of the day, WWE will do whatever USA wants them to do. And USA, the reason they asked WWE to do that is because they realize that wrestling is one of their biggest ratings grabbers on their network. They're in very tight competition with ESPN for the number one cable network every single week. It's a constant battle between the two networks. So any opportunity when sweeps comes along for them to say, you know what, Vince, give us 3 hours of television this week, and if they could pop a decent rating for that three-hour Raw, it'll help their network overall. That's why they do it. Ben writes in, dear Solemn Monster, I'm just listening to the sound off, and you mentioned Rowdy Roddy Piper's Intercontinental title win at the 1992 Royal Rumble, and I had an idea. On Monday's Raw, why not have Kane in a U.S. title match with Jack Swagger and have Kane beat him for the championship? The storyline could be that Kane brags that he has Ryder's most prized possession, angering John Cena even more, and Cena and Kane can fight over the U.S. title. It would raise the prestige of the belt so much by having Cena and Kane fighting over it, and Cena could either claim that he'll give Zack an automatic title shot when he wins, or just straight up give the championship to Zack if he wins it. But I think it would give the title some added prestige. Well, first of all, you had me going there until you said that Cena and Kane should feud over the U.S. title. First of all, that would imply that Cena and Kane's feud is going to continue even longer. I don't want that to happen. That's number one. I believe their feud is going to be over as of Elimination Chamber, they're probably going to have a last man standing match. I want it to be over at that. It has to be over at that point anyway, because The Rock is coming back, and they need to start building Rock and Cena for WrestleMania. So there wouldn't even be enough time for that, number one. Number two, this notion that Cena would win the U.S. title and give the title to Zack Ryder is one of the worst ideas I've ever heard in my life. You want to castrate Zack Ryder, you know, insinuating the only way he can get the U.S. belt back is if John Cena, his buddy, gives it to him. That's a terrible idea, but I'm going to give Ben a lot of credit here. One thing he said that I actually think would be a tremendous idea would be to have the U.S. title moved over to Kane. Have Kane beat Jack Swagger for the United States Championship, because at the end of the day, the title doesn't mean anything on Swagger. It's not elevating him. So elevate the title by getting it on an established guy and building to Zack Ryder coming back and challenging Kane for the title at WrestleMania, where he can finally get his big win and get back the U.S. title. If they play their cards that way, Zack Ryder gets a big match at WrestleMania. We have the U.S. title on Kane for a little while anyway, and Kane's still a big guy. He's a main event guy. It'll elevate the title a little bit. And if you build to WrestleMania and have Zack finally stand up to Kane, beat Kane, get the championship back, I think that is a great, great idea. Adrian from Melbourne, Australia writes, and I was listening to episode 185, and you said you would not be interested in paying to listen to Gail Kim shoot on WWE. My question is, which current WWE superstar, referee, or announcer would you actually look forward to hearing shoot on the company? I would love to see an Undertaker shoot, quite frankly. I think if Undertaker, and I don't ever see him doing this, but if you could ever convince him to sit down independently, especially, but even if WWE wanted to get into the business of doing, quote, shoot interviews and try to put RF Video and High Spots and all these other companies out of business, Undertaker would be the first guy at the top of my list. I mean, think about the fascinating stories that he probably has. And Undertaker doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who would necessarily be a big bullshit artist like Hulk Hogan, for example, or Kurt Angle. Undertaker, I think, has been in that company long enough and has seen a lot of guys come and a lot of guys go and would have some very interesting tales to tell, I think. The ones that he would share. Undertaker does also strike me as the kind of guy that would want to maintain some sort of code and probably would not share a lot of stuff either. But to see him sit down, the closest thing he's ever done to something like that, he did an interview on Off the Record, which is that TSN show hosted by Michael Landsberg back in 2003, I believe, when he was doing the Big Evil character. And I believe he had the short, cropped hair. And it was the closest thing to a shoot interview I've ever seen The Undertaker do. And he actually talked about WrestleMania 14, for example. And there were some rumors that Shawn Michaels was not going to do the right thing and was all of a sudden unwilling to put Steve Austin over, and that Undertaker had to go talk to Michaels and was taping his fists as he explained to Michaels that he had better do the right thing. And Shawn got the message pretty quickly at that point, and there were no problems, and he lost to Steve Austin. So he was talking about stuff like that and only shared so much. I mean, it wasn't a terribly in-depth shoot interview or anything like that, but it's the only time I've ever seen Undertaker out of character do any sort of interview like that. And I would love to see a full-blown shoot with the guy. I think he'd have a lot of interesting stories to tell. Last question here. Brandon Corral from Las Vegas writes in, if you were to have a son one day, Solo Monster 2, yeah, if I want my son to get his ass kicked every day at school, that's the name I would give him. Anyway, what match would you show him first to bring him into the wrestling world? That's a pretty good question that I've never been asked before. I gave this some thought. I've got a lot of favorite matches. You know, the first match that actually popped into my head was one of my all-time favorite matches, if not my favorite match, which is Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker from WrestleMania 25. You will not find very many, if any, matches better than that one from start to finish. But the thing about that match that I don't think would be good necessarily for a brand-new wrestling fan or a young wrestling fan is that the reason that match worked as well as it did, it would have worked anyway, even if you weren't familiar with the history between Shawn and Undertaker. But it worked well because you knew the history between them and because you had already established the super kick as a finishing maneuver and the tombstone as a finishing maneuver. So when Undertaker hit that first tombstone and Shawn kicked out, you couldn't believe it. When Shawn hit that last super kick and you thought that's the end of it, you know, it was a great false finish, and I think that's lost on some people if they don't already have it well established in their mind, the super kick, the tombstone, and all that kind of stuff. So I shied away from picking that match, and I also shied away from picking, for example, Bret Hart and Steve Austin at WrestleMania 13, another great match, because that match had the weapons and the blood. And, you know, if you have a little... First of all, if he's a young kid, I don't necessarily want him to see that, number one. Number two, I don't want him to think that every wrestling match is going to have steel chairs and blood. So you've got to keep that in mind, too. This is their very first wrestling match. What do you want them to see? This is going to be their first impression of what wrestling is. What match can I think of that would be a great wrestling match on its own and fun enough that would convince somebody, hey, this is pretty cool, I think I might watch more of this? I go back to Randy Savage and Ricky Steamboat at WrestleMania 3. I just think that match on its own, no weapons, no blood, no bullshit. You had the little bit of interference at the end by George Steele. It was a great match. It's a fun match. It's a fast-paced match. It was a match that was way ahead of its time. But even if you go back and watch it in 2012, it doesn't seem dated. You know, big crowd, 90-something thousand people, or 78, depending on who you believe. Everything about that match was pitch perfect. So I think Randy Savage and Ricky Steamboat from WrestleMania 3 would probably be the match that I would show my son if he had never seen wrestling before. That does it for the mailbag this week. You can email me your questions in the future, as always, thesolemonster@gmail.com. There's a whole bunch of new questions from over the last couple of days that I've gotten that I didn't get to, but I was a little backlogged since I didn't do a normal one last week, so I apologize for that. Keep sending in your questions, your comments. Again, if you leave me a review in iTunes, let me know. I'll mention you on the Sound Off here. Follow me on Twitter, friend me on Facebook, all that good stuff, and of course I'm on YouTube as well. You can find me at The Solemonster. If you are a new fan, because I know we picked up a lot of new fans from all over the world, drop me a note, say hello, introduce yourself. We'd love to hear from you. We'll be back here next weekend with episode 205. This has been the Solemonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com. Until next time, be well, stay safe. Take care, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solemonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.